Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Local school districts are struggling with their budgets. CMS, Union County, Gaston, and Cabarrus counties are all dealing with money issues. We talk about that later in the program and speak with Mecklenburg County State Senator Caleb Tedros about his time in the General Assembly. But first, yesterday, the year-old impasse over the state budget experienced a breakthrough. And here to tell us what he knows about the budget deal is North Carolina Newsroom reporter Adam Wagner. Adam, welcome back. Good to see you.
Morning, Mike.
Thank you for being here. When it happened, it was almost a year overdue, but it did happen yesterday afternoon, about 4 o'clock. House and Senate Republicans announced that they have come to an agreement on a long-delayed budget.
This is a starting point. There's still a lot that will need to be decided and discussed between the two chambers, but this agreement sets out a good framework for us to move forward. The talks that the Speaker and I have had have been extremely productive, and I'm hopeful that as we begin the full budget conference process, we'll be able to move quickly.
Senate Leader Phil Berger, Adam, what broke the stalemate?
Sure. So let's just start with what this is and what this isn't. This is not a full budget agreement. This is not, we do not have a budget document. We don't even, frankly, have anything to really read yet. What this is an agreement on a bunch of the top line issues that we're keeping talks from progressing. So this is things like the income tax triggers that we've been talking about for feels like 18 months now. Those have been repealed. Instead, your state income tax is 3.99%. Under the terms of this deal, it'll go to 3.49% next year, 3.24% 3 years after that, 2.99% 3 years after that. And then there will be some triggers coming in. This is also importantly some raises for state employees and teachers. Most state employees would see 3%. Teachers would see an average of 8%. State law enforcement would see between 10 and 20%, depending on their agencies. What this is not is retroactive pay for those employees for the time we have not had a budget. Instead, there are some bonuses.
So, as you said, this is not the budget. This is an icebreaker. This is the fact that the ice is melting a little bit around the edges, and they're going to work on it. And that was underlined yesterday by House Speaker Destin Hall.
Both of our chambers have reached largely an agreement on the big issues that now allow all of our members and our chairs to work towards some of the other things in the budget, and I'm confident that we'll be able to get a comprehensive budget done relatively soon, but there's still a lot of work to do.
So the final vote on this could be weeks away. As he said, they have lots of work to do and it will take a while. So why announce the deal now if there's nothing on paper and the ink is not, that's not dry, it's not even wet yet?
Yeah, it's not on paper yet. Yesterday, apparently the appropriations chairs, the budget writers from both chambers haven't really been meeting. They're starting to meet yesterday now that these top line things have been agreed. I think the reason to announce it is just to, for Republicans from both chambers to say, we're moving here. They've been getting questions every single day about where's the budget, what's happening with the budget, what's happening with the income tax triggers, where are the raises? And this really, I think, is a signal to the public, to state employees, that there are agreements now, we are moving towards a budget. Now, again, that budget is still at least 4 or 6 weeks away, like, from actually happening. So there's a lot of runway between here and there.
So for a year now, this has been a disagreement between House Republicans and Senate Republicans because they control everything in the legislature. Would this impasse have broken had it not been for the fact that Phil Berger, who is arguably has been the most powerful politician in the state, had he been reelected? Or is there a little relenting of his stance because he's a lame duck?
Yeah, I don't think we have a great sense for that. Senator Berger has certainly changed his position on these income tax triggers. He had been really locked in on the idea that we made a promise to the public, we need to scale down income taxes. Now, I asked about this yesterday. He said we are going to the 3.49% we promised. As part of that deal, the House agreed to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot this fall that will put a permanent cap of 3.5% on personal income tax. So it would never be, the income, say personal income tax would never be higher than the level it's going to be starting next year. So it'd be lower than it is right now permanently.
One of the sticking points has been over the personal income tax rate and how quickly it would fall. And you mentioned that they have agreed, or they have at least talked about triggers that would change the personal income tax rate from 3.99% to 3.49% in the next couple of years, with further reductions later on to 2.99%. What did they decide, if anything, about the corporate tax rate? Because they wanted to bring that to zero.
So the corporate tax rate still remains on a glide path to zero. That is not changing at all under this agreement. And House Minority Leader Robert Reeves got asked about that yesterday. He was pretty critical of that, arguing that if you're trying to get more revenue for the state, a lot of the corporate income tax money, when you cut that money goes out of state. So if you're going to start, you know, maybe that dial should have been turned too, was his argument.
Later in the program, we're going to talk about budget problems at various school systems around Mecklenburg County, including CMS, where they passed their school budget last night. We'll talk about that with James Farrell from WFAE in a moment. But in this budget that the impasse broke yesterday on in Raleigh, teachers are scheduled to get, I believe this is correct, an 8% pay increase, and both teachers and state employees are scheduled to receive bonuses of between $1,000 and $1,750. What are those bonuses based on?
So this gets a little bit tricky. For state employees, if you earn less than $65,000, it's a $1,750 bonus. If you earn more than that, it's a $1,000 bonus. Teachers are totally separate. If you're a teacher with more than 16 years of experience, you get $1,000. If you get less than 16 years of experience, it'd be a $500 bonus. What we haven't seen yet is a teacher pay schedule. Teacher pay is kind of complicated. The way I read those bonuses, again, not having seen a schedule, is that the teacher pay increases will likely be more significant earlier in careers. That would explain why their bonus is lower than teachers that are receiving money.
And that's been a complaint by teachers, that they're not being compensated for experience or higher education, that the brunt of these teacher pay raises are going to inexperienced newcomers. Is that simply because we want to attract people to the profession? What about retaining them?
Sure. I'm not sure on that.
Okay. All right.
Education is not my own specialty.
And teachers have been waiting for these raises for a while now, as have state employees. Will they be, you may have already said this, I didn't hear it, will they be retroactive?
Yeah, they will not be. So That's where these bonuses, that Hall and Berger saying that's where the bonuses come in. The bonuses are meant to kind of make up for they're not being retroactive. I haven't seen a great analysis anywhere of like, how do those compare? You know, they are arguing that in some cases, these bonuses will be more money in people's pockets than an actual retroactive raise. That might be true for the people making less than $65,000. I'm not so sure that's going to be true elsewhere.
You also mentioned two constitutional amendments. There are, if this goes through as it presently stands, there could be two constitutional amendments on the November ballot for voters to decide on. And one would be something that Mecklenburg County leaders have vehemently opposed, and that is a cap, I believe, on property taxes, because that would impinge on what governments, local governments, county governments can bring in from property taxes, which is their principal source of revenue. Where does that stand?
So the House has put forward a bill that would put a levy limit on November's ballot. Now, levy limit's a little bit tricky to understand because it's not necessarily a cap on the property tax rate, but it would be a limit on how much revenue can be earned through property tax. So it kind of addresses both the property, the tax rate and the revaluation piece. County leaders across the state, the Association of County Commissioners, they've been very clear they do not want this. This would be a pretty significant throttle on what local governments can do. And then the other piece of it would be the 3.5% cap on personal income tax rates. That would come more from the Senate.
But when it comes to capping property taxes, that would impact, according to local leaders, it would impact everything from public safety to road repairs to teacher pay. Here we go back to teacher pay again. Will counties have any leverage in this, do you think, with members of the General Assembly, even through their own? The problem, I think, in Mecklenburg County is that we have a pretty heavy Democratic representation. Will they be heard in the General Assembly?
They will certainly be voicing their opinions. I think that's true. I think we started seeing that yesterday with Senator Batch's statement and with House Minority Leader Reeves's comments. As far as how much they will influence this process, we'll see. The people that might have influence might be those now newly unaffiliated representatives of Mecklenburg County who could make this thing veto-proof.
Adam Wagner, who is a General Assembly reporter for North Carolina Newsroom, thank you very much for your time and for updating us on that. What happened yesterday afternoon. I'm going to bring in Mecklenburg Senator Caleb Tedros, who represents District 41 that covers West Charlotte, the Plaza Midwood. And when he was first elected 2 years ago, he became the youngest member serving in the state Senate. During his time in that body, he's introduced several pieces of legislation, including one to decriminalize marijuana, another to help school athletic coaches recognize and respond to student mental health needs. We're going to talk about all of that and more, but I want to start, Senator, with the passage or the promise of the passage of the budget yesterday. From your point of view, what broke the impasse?
Yeah, I think it's very important to kind of label this what it is. I mean, it was essentially a general framework that was introduced, followed by a press conference. And so I am thankful to see that there's some kind of improvement in negotiations. I mean, a step up pay increase for teachers is definitely helpful in terms of one of the overarching frameworks that have been introduced. But, you know, again, I think we're still at month 10. We're overdue for a budget. I would like to see continued progress on that front and actually a formal budget introduced to state legislators. And so, much like you said, I do have concerns over some of the items that have been introduced, including the constitutional amendments. I think putting a permanent cap on a state's ability to bring in revenue years before we even know how much the state is going to bring in is financially completely irresponsible. And so I think, you know, I guess promising to hear that we have something, but, you know, a general framework in a press conference, I think is a step, but a small step.
I want to talk just a second about these 3% pay raises, because I know that there are some Democrats in the General Assembly who were disgruntled by that for state employees, the 3%, because the inflation rate is 3.8%. Could that be solved? Could more be coming to those employees were it not for these tax cuts? And I have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I think ultimately you have to balance the budget somehow. And so for every time we lower the top income tax rate and lower the corporate tax rate, there's someone else going to be paying the price. And again, in this instance, a 3% pay increase when it's barely keeping up with the inflation for our public employees is unacceptable. And so I think these are the second, third order effects of being financially irresponsible. And I share those sentiments with some of my counterparts in having concerns about that.
State Senator Caleb Tedros from District 41, which includes West Charlotte, the Plaza Midwood, with us. We'll come back with more of our conversation with him and more on the budget, some political thoughts, and some of the bills that he's introduced when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with State Senator Caleb Tedros, District 41, elected in 2024. He represents West Charlotte and Plaza Midwood, and we're talking at the moment about the budget impasse being broken yesterday. We'll move on to other topics as we go through the next segment here, and I want to mention that the senator is speaking to us from a meeting room in Raleigh, which has other people in it, which may explain some of the background noise that we're hearing. The impasse over the budget has been between, as I said in the last segment, between House Republicans and Senate Republicans, and they have now come to this, I guess, meeting of the minds. At least they're willing to work on something going forward. Democrats are in the minority. Were you included in these discussions? Will you be included in these discussions, or will it be presented to you as a fait accompli?
Yeah, much like the earlier budget items that were introduced by the House and Senate, traditionally this is dropped on Senate Democrats' office maybe the night before, if we're lucky. And so just explain how things work. If you are in the minority, in this instance, the super minority, the last go around in budget discussions, we got it, I believe, at Monday at 5 p.m. And then that Tuesday morning is when the budget was read in committee. So I suspect it'll be similar.
You are the former chair of the Black Political Caucus, a very powerful group here in the Charlotte area. You went to Harding High School. You went to UNC Charlotte. You're a hometowner. You studied economics there. You worked for a while, I believe, in the banking industry. But you're also a longtime Democrat. But it is the Republicans who have a longtime reputation for being conservative, fiscally conservative. I'm wondering why you're a Democrat.
Yeah, I think I would kind of push back on that. There is that general stereotype of Democrats being a little bit more fiscally, I guess, liberal and not as conservative. I think ultimately, just because someone wants to invest in actual social programs that uplift people that will have a later return on investment does not make them fiscally not conservative or irresponsible. I think that if a proper investment is made to people who are going to, in return, return on that investment in the city in the form of education, in the form of paying a living wage, I think those things are actually responsible, which I think the Democrats stand for.
You're also in a body, the legislature, that has seen some defections from the Democratic Party of late. Tricia Cotham switched from a Democrat to Republican a couple of years ago, and just recently Carla Cunningham and Nasif Majid moved away from the Democratic Party and put themselves in the unaffiliated category. All three complained about feeling controlled by the party and shunned when they didn't toe the party line. I'm wondering if you have felt any of that pressure.
No, I mean, as a matter of fact, not at all. If you see some of the Senate Democrats and even House Democrats, we have diverse viewpoints. Again, there are folks that are interested, like myself, maybe in technology. I have a specific viewpoint that might not align with my colleagues when it comes to crypto, AI, et cetera. But you know, I've always been pushed, whether it's the governor or our leadership, to kind of express my opinion and kind of follow my own interests. And so I haven't necessarily seen that. Now, that doesn't mean other folks don't feel that as well. There are, you know, complaints, especially from national political parties on both sides of the aisle. You know, we kind of obviously focus on North Carolina, but there are other states where you're seeing the same kind of reaction from Republicans as well. And so, again, we get elected by our constituents to follow in the values that they elected us for. And I feel like, you know, you allow the democratic process to kind of take shape. But, yes, speaking directly, I have not felt that pressure.
You're also in politics at a time when people are questioning whether or not democracy in this country will survive. And one of the maneuvers that is taking place around the country right now is political gerrymandering. The Republicans in North Carolina have indulged in this, but so did Democrats when they were in control of the House and Senate. It's a little stronger now, I think, because of the abilities given to people because of computer technology and the way to really laser focus certain of these areas. But political gerrymandering also intersects with racial gerrymandering. You can't really divide the two in some cases. What are your thoughts on what we should do about gerrymandering? Because that and Citizens United and other aspects that have come along the last 10 or 15 years have really reduced the one person, one vote concept?
Yeah, 100%. I think at no point should figuring out what political lines be chosen by a politician. I think the incentives don't even make sense. I think you've seen a lot of times, on both sides of the aisle, that the very people that are most interested in getting back to their seats, they should not have the power to essentially elect who their actual voters are.
Is there any political power to change that, to go to some kind of nonpartisan commission that draws the districts here or anywhere else in the country?
Yeah, I mean, you've seen a lot of, I mean, California right now is through a referendum, they undid their sort of bipartisan or nonpartisan maps. And so there are a lot of places in the United States that have pursued this, and it's very popular amongst voters as well. And I think in North Carolina, again, this is ground zero for racial gerrymandering. People have said that Democrats do this as well. Listen, I was in middle school the last time Democrats were in control doing this, so I can't really answer to the generation before me. But again, now speaking objectively, it doesn't make sense for politicians to draw their own maps.
Given the rising cost of everything and the growing unpopularity of the current administration, Democrats did seem for a while to be poised to take control of the Congress. But because of these redistricting efforts around the country, that may be dimming a little bit. You have written some very thoughtful pieces about this on your Substack. What must listeners, voters, understand about the Democratic Party and their approach to governing if you hope to gain any traction at the national or the state level?
Yeah, I think if you follow along the pattern, whether it's at the national or even at the state level, there's been a huge divergence amongst political parties in our attempt to bring people into the process versus excluding them. Time after time, we see studies that suggest that we do not see any kind of voter fraud. In a country where you have 2030 and Charlotte's much worse in terms of political participation, we should be doing even more to include that people are able to vote. Like, you should be involved in the civic process in the United States. And we as leaders have an opportunity to actually enhance your ability to vote. We want more folks to vote, more folks for their voices to be heard. And so I find it logical that a party's popularity that's declining goes out of their way in order to ensure that folks are not voting. And so it makes sense from that perspective. But again, the more people that vote, the better. So we are beholden to our constituents and our voters, and we have to have values that reflect them. You don't suggest that my voters don't think as me, therefore let me cut them out of my district, which is what you've seen from the opposing party.
Let's talk about you and some of the things that you've been involved in your time in the legislature. There have been several attempts over time to change the laws surrounding marijuana in this state. There have been several decriminalization bills filed over the years. I think Representative Kelly Alexander, who was on this program many times talking about this, first did this in 2009. None of the bills proposed by him or others have received full votes. There have been repeated attempts to consider medical cannabis bills. None have passed both chambers. Recently, Senate Bill 1027 proposed two constitutional amendments, one to legalize personal use of cannabis, one to legalize medical cannabis. It was filed, but as I understand it, there's been no movement on that. And you helped sponsor Senate Bill 1072, which proposes putting decriminalization and medical use questions directly on the ballot to bypass legislative gridlock. First, the gridlock. There's a reason for that. So if there's a reason for that that prevents the legislature from taking action on any of these bills, why would they take action on a bill to allow the voters to decide?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, this becomes a conversation about letting your voice be heard versus actual cannabis. Mike, we started this segment with the fact that this General Assembly finally has talking points for a budget 10 months after it was due. The General Assembly has been incapable of being kind of thoughtful in providing any kind of legislation around cannabis. I mean, this has been a topic in the nation and within the state for the past 20, 30 years now, and appropriate or responsible guardrails have not been introduced. And so our bill simply takes the general choice out of the hands of our politicians and puts it into the voters. There is a general gap between what a politician in North Carolina believes in cannabis and what their voters do. Polling and time again has shown us for both recreational and medical marijuana usage. So independent of what you think, you can be for marijuana, you can be for medical marijuana, it doesn't even matter. This actually allows you to go to the polls and vote whether you want this legalized or not, or decriminalized or not.
Well, as you mentioned, public polling in the state shows that voters are ahead of the General Assembly on this. They are, more and more people are favoring, I'm not sure it's a majority yet, but it could be, favoring the legalization of marijuana. And last month, the federal government has begun to treat marijuana no longer as a Schedule I drug for medical use or research. So is the tide turning? Do you have a shot at this? Where does your bill stand?
I think so. Again, I mean, it is in Rules Committee right now, but what is it, May 13th?
Isn't that where bills go to die, the Rules Committee?
True. That's where they all go to start as well. Okay. But you know, listen, we introduced it 7 days ago. We have Senator Candy Smith, who's leading the bill effort, who is chair of the Legislative Black Caucus, and she's on the bipartisan cannabis task force for the governor. And so, you know, again, listen, we are Democrats. Is it a long shot? Yes. But, you know, I get sent here not to sit around and sit on my hands because I'm in the minority, but to actually introduce bills, be creative, and figure out how to get things across the finish line for constituents.
There are currently criminal penalties attached to marijuana in many states, including ours, and in places where marijuana has been legalized to various degrees. Do you know if there has been any uptick in crime, an increase in medical and or health issues, or an increase of driving while impaired issues because somebody's not on alcohol, but they're high on marijuana?
Yeah, from those states, I think you're going to get mixed reviews over the second, third order effect of introducing legislation like this. I mean, obviously, whenever we introduce legislation around cannabis or any substance, we need the Attorney General in our office to discuss this. We need subject matter experts. We need law enforcement. I think this bill initially puts it up to the voters to determine what they think about these two issues. And then after that, we have thoughtful discussions over the proper implementation so that we can look out for things like driving under the influence, so that we can reinforce and ensure that we have the proper infrastructure.
Because of our laws here and elsewhere, people have been prosecuted and convicted for possession and use and put in jail for possession and use of marijuana. And you have spoken about the, quote, disproportionate application of the law, meaning that some people are arrested more often for this than others. And we know who we're talking about. It has affected an individual's ability to get a job upon release from that incarceration. Does your bill deal at all with expunging the records of those related to marijuana convictions if we then legalize marijuana?
Not this specific bill. And so after this bill is introduced, there are a litany of bills that we plan to introduce as well that have to do with expungement and other policy around this. This simply puts it up to the voters whether they think that we should decriminalize medical marijuana or decriminalize recreational use of marijuana. So to your point, yeah, there are many things that we need to go after this bill is passed and after the voters make their voices heard, with expungement being at the top of the list.
When it comes to the medical use of marijuana, you've pointed that for treatment purposes, quote, we use opiates a lot. Opiates, you say, are extremely dangerous on so many different levels. To get people off of opiates, cannabis has proven to be a pathway to help people move away. Those are your words. Is that a point of view that is clearly understood by your fellow legislators?
Yeah, there are many folks, including both sides of the aisle, that understand that as well. And most importantly, I think subject matter experts and physicians and researchers have made this point. And so we should be logical and reason through these things. And so if we suggest that a specific drug should not be used, we need to go back to the research and really determine what it says.
And over the last half century, this state has loosened its alcohol laws. This used to be a brown bag city years ago, and when they dropped those laws, the restaurant industry blossomed. Alcohol, like marijuana, is a drug. Is there a difference in your mind between the two?
Yeah, I think, ultimately there is a difference between the two, but I think the more kind of accurate description of what's taking place is not comparing the brown bag laws, but comparing it to prohibition. I think, again, we don't want this free reign, no rules around cannabis. This is simply allowing voters to make their voices heard over whether we should decriminalize these issues or not. But yeah, I mean, I do definitely realize that there's a difference between the two.
You also introduced Senate Bill 550. That's the Coaches Care Act, which is aimed at helping coaches, athletic coaches in public schools, lower, what am I trying to say? Not higher education, but, you know, high schools and junior high schools, recognize and respond to student mental health needs before they worsen. Why is this aimed just at coaches? Why not teachers? Why not counselors? Why not other faculty and staff members?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, baby steps. I think I agree. This is something that I pushed at CMS, which is to get teachers the ability to get them mental health first aid training as well. We see CMPD, this is a requirement for them. So we thought that an additional step would be to try to get a coaches, partially because of the place that coaches oftentimes hold in a child's life. Listen, especially in Charlotte, I mean, I grew up playing sports, but a coach is oftentimes a father figure to some of these kids. And so that if we can nudge them a bit closer to understanding the effects of mental health on those kids as well, we'd be that much closer to solving this mental health gap.
Suicide is the second leading cause of death among children in the state, and one in seven young people experience a mental health disorder every year. How would your bill work to reduce those numbers, or do you think it would work to reduce those numbers?
I think, yeah, if you look at any stat around the mental health first aid, this is the training given by the National Society for Wellbeing, pretty much the gold standard of training around mental health. You know, Florida has a requirement for all teachers. This was backed by Republicans, bipartisan support. And we've shown through study after study that this helps kids. This helps in terms of identifying those things. And just logically, we have a physical first aid kit in pretty much every room to ensure that a kid's life is not endangered. And so we need that same toolkit for a kid's mental health as well. And this is all that it simply does.
I have about 30 seconds left, but 2 weeks ago, good news for you, this bill received the unanimous support of the North Carolina High School Athletic Association. That organization also voted to require all high school sports head coaches to undergo youth mental health training every 3 years. Could that endorsement help move the needle and help move your bill through the General Assembly?
I think so. I mean, people on both sides of the aisle realize the importance of this bill, and I'm glad the High School Association also recognizes this too. And so, and that's my point to all the other bills. Even if we're in the super minority, Mike, we're going to figure out a way to pass policy and to ensure the folks that need the resources are going to get it.
State Senator Caleb Tedros from District 41, which is West Charlotte through Plaza Midwood, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate your time. When we come back, school budgets are the topic. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. School systems surrounding Mecklenburg County are experiencing money woes. Union, Cabarrus, and Gaston County schools are either cutting budgets or asking for more money. And CMS spent more than a week wrangling over and revising their budget request to Mecklenburg County, which passed last night. It all deserves a closer look, and to help us with that, we're joined by WFAE education reporter James Farrell. And because some of these budget issues stem from the lack of a state budget, we'll also talk about how that passage or the impasse being broken might impact what some of these people are struggling with. James, welcome to the program. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice. Let's start with CMS. The board rejected Superintendent Crystal Hill's proposed $2.1 billion budget a couple of weeks ago. They offered very little guidance at first. They held an early Saturday morning meeting that she was at and then left. Again, very little information about what was worked on emerged, at least to me, emerged from that meeting. But yesterday was, the deadline for the presentation of a new budget. It was presented, and the board said yes. What's different about the budget that passed last night from the one Crystal Hill presented several weeks ago?
Yeah, so in the grand scheme of things, the differences here are more like minor tweaks that kind of hit on what had kind of become sticking points in the conversations we've heard over the last week or so, where we've been having these at times kind of tense special hearings that they've been trying to hammer out the details here. So the overall numbers here are the same as what Dr. Hill initially proposed. It's a $2.1 billion spending plan. The teacher supplement increase is an average 5% increase request to Mecklenburg County. So all those kind of like headline numbers are the same. The changes were more sort of reallocating where money is going. So for instance, one of the big changes was the elimination of this $2.4 million expense on this social emotional learning program called Capturing Kids' Hearts. Some board members had raised questions about whether this program was effective, and they wanted to maybe see that money go toward other social emotional learning opportunities. So this budget commits to doing that, reallocating that money to that. There was some kind of shifting in where teachers are going. They moved about three teacher positions to different schools. That was a big topic of conversation, how the district sort of allots teachers to schools based off of enrollment. So that appeared to be an attempt to kind of satiate the board's hope to see more teachers at struggling schools, for instance. And really, outside of that, there wasn't like a lot of major changes here. They changed their assumption in what they assume the state is going to give teachers, obviously, with all the conversation. And yesterday, with the proposal of an 8% raise for teachers, initially, Dr. Hill had proposed a 3% raise, or at least assuming that the budget would assume for a 3% state raise. But the board had wanted to see that number maybe be a little bit higher, given conversations had suggested that number might be higher. So this budget assumes a 5% increase in the state, in the state raises.
And the state passed, they're looking at an 8% pay raise. How will that ultimately impact CMS's bottom line and what they're going to have to ask for or get from the county to supplement that?
Yeah, so that was a big question at last night's meeting. Chief Finance Officer Kelly Klutz said that they believe the current budget is set up to be able to accommodate for whatever the state ends up doing. They said in the context of the CMS budget, it might end up being more like a 6% increase because they don't know how that 8% raise is going to be spread out. They know, for instance, non-certified staff will probably get a less raise. So overall, they think that with the contingencies that they put in there, the cuts that they have made to kind of guard against a larger increase, they think, at least initially, that that they will be able to accommodate. Now, an important point, though, is that, like we've been talking about, this is just a framework of a deal. We don't know the specifics yet. So as that changes, that could cause more conversations about potential cuts and readjustments and things like that.
I want to come back to the social and emotional learning component of this, because that seemed to be a topic of concern among school board members when the first budget presentation happened and in the interim between that and last night's passage. And you mentioned this program called Capturing Kids' Hearts. We've done a lot of education programs on this program. I've never heard about that program ever. So tell me what it is, and tell me what emotional and social learning is.
Yeah, so Capturing Kids' Hearts, to the best of my understanding, is a district-wide framework, they call it. It provides things like professional development for teachers, and it aims to try to give teachers strategies to improve school culture, improve morale, things like that for students. When we talk about social emotional learning, that's often tied to mental health and tied to trying to make, make sure that kids are doing okay emotionally as well as academically. But there had been a lot of questions from the board about the data that the district was using to judge whether this was an effective program. I had heard some rumblings from parents who were concerned about kind of the expenditure on this and questions about what this program even was and whether it was worth the money that the district was spending. So they had suggested maybe trying to reallocate that money towards, like, for instance, the district's own behavioral modification technicians and their own like kind of internal social emotional learning strategies. And they also committed to going out to an RFP for maybe finding some sort of other program that can provide direct supports to students who might be struggling with mental health and things like that.
The tenor of that budget presentation a couple of weeks ago was extraordinary, because it was the first time since I can remember, since 2023, when Crystal Hill became the superintendent, that there was any friction whatsoever between her and the board. And there seemed to be a lot of friction between her and the board. Does this fix that? I know that there's an emergency session of the school board. That's an odd word to use, to concentrate on personnel issues. It started at 7 o'clock this morning. What do we know about that? And is that related to this friction?
Yeah, we don't know anything for sure, but obviously the timing is interesting. There were a couple of other closed sessions that happened over the last week as they've been going through this budget process. Certainly from the outside, when you look at the timing and you look at how tense some of those hearings have gotten, it certainly raises questions about the state of the relationship between the board and Hill, which, like you said, up to this point, had really not had a lot of friction and had not had a lot of tensions and things like that. I will say, after the meeting yesterday, I did talk to Board Chair Stephanie need. I asked kind of how the board moves on from this. And she had kind of just said, we just have to move on to the next thing. We're a school district. We have a lot of things to do. I asked if the board still had confidence in Dr. Hill. And she said, well, you didn't hear anything from the dais suggesting otherwise. This was obviously a difficult time. It doesn't suggest just a difficult time doesn't necessarily mean that there's a lack of confidence. So not quite a direct yes or no. So we're going to have to wait and see and see what that next thing is that they talk about, what comes out of this meeting today, if anything. I have not heard anything specifically about this morning's meeting. It was definitely curious seeing that emergency notice go out immediately after all of this budget tension appeared to have kind of ended, because at the meeting last night, the morale on the budget talks was a little bit better than it had been. The board seemed appreciative of the changes. They seemed to believe the budget was better. And then we get this notice about the emergency meeting. So those questions are definitely still going to remain.
Is it possible that some of this friction could be resulting from the uncertainty that was swirling around the lack of a state budget, and that perhaps that's going to dissipate now because we know pretty much what the outlines of the budget and the money coming in from the state is going to be?
Yeah, I think even as we start talking about the other school districts here, I think that's a common thread through all of this. There's been so much uncertainty in school districts who are trying to plan their finances without knowing what the budget's going to say, without knowing what teacher raises are going to be. And I think that has undoubtedly caused tensions for school boards as they're trying to figure this out, tensions between school boards and their local counties. So absolutely, I think that has played a role. Whether or not it will dissipate now, you know, I don't know. I mean, things seem to get almost kind of personal toward the end of these. There was, you know, kind of some accusations that maybe staff was talking down to the board. You know, and that's a whole other question still.
So let's move on to Union County Public Schools, which last September became the highest performing school district in the state. And yet they are grappling with a projected $10 million shortfall in state funding. It's not tied to the lack of a budget, but it's also tied, maybe it's partly tied to that, but it's also tied to declining enrollment. And CMS is facing declining enrollment. Is that because of demographics? Or is that because of the opportunity scholarships siphoning students out of public schools?
That's definitely a debate right now. I mean, at least from CMS's perspective, they've pointed to demographic studies that have suggested that this has to do with birth rates. They have projections that show that this had always been kind of foreseen, this idea that there would be a dip in enrollment before later growth. Certainly looking at vouchers, looking at the growth of charter schools, which have seen increases in enrollment, is going to continue to raise questions about what's actually causing these enrollment declines. For Union County, I'm not as confident as to the reasons for those declines, but what I can say is that I know almost every district in the state is struggling with declining enrollment, which is just adding to these tensions.
So Union County is reacting to the shortfall in one way by overhauling its school media program. They're talking about eliminating, or maybe they have eliminated, 11 positions, and they're moving away from having a dedicated media coordinator at every school. Are these people the individuals we used to refer to as librarians? And if so, what will the impact of that be?
Yes, this is basically the same as librarians. They have a lot more hats now with all the different kind of media that a library might contain. There's been a lot of concern about this on social media from parents who are worried about what it's going to mean to not have sort of a dedicated media coordinator at every school. You know, the new model is going to create kind of these media coordinators will serve like clusters of schools. But there's concern, especially as we talk about literacy scores and wanting kids to read and getting them excited about reading and not having sort of that regular face in the school building. You know, what's that going to do for that process? But, you know, obviously, this is something that UCPS feels is necessary to do as they're trying to accommodate this decline in state funding.
What else are they cutting?
I have not seen anything else explicitly said. In their statement about the media coordinators, they did mention that they have been reallocating things. It's worth noting that they're also not saying these are not layoffs per se. They've collapsed these positions. They've offered them the opportunity to apply to different roles. At least five of the positions were either vacant or soon to be vacant. So I think it's more sort of a lot of that kind of moving people around, reallocating people to different positions throughout the district in order to kind of collapse some vacant positions and save money that way.
At the same time, Union County School Board approved a $174 million budget for the next year, roughly $14 million more than last year. And that includes 5% increases for pay for teachers and other employees. But they say these salary projections are estimates. Are they dependent on what ultimately happens in Raleigh?
Yes, and I think part of it too is also the local supplement. That's going to depend on what Union County commissioners say as well.
Okay.
So, I mean, as the case with all school districts, they're kind of dependent on other entities for almost all of their funding. So,
Gaston County Schools have been having money issues for a little bit now, a couple of months now. We've been talking about it. And recently, Gaston County commissioners asked to see alternative budget options that would allow them to provide more money to Gaston County Schools. This is in the face of a decision by Gaston County Schools to present a budget request to the commission that was smaller than previous versions. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so, you know, this was done. Superintendent Morgan Houchard had basically said that he wanted to present a budget that was realistic. And as you mentioned, Gaston County has had a lot of money problems recently. We know that they had to ask for an emergency influx of $10 million from the county because they had a mid-year shortfall that was caused by some budgeting issues, by the decline of low wealth supplements that they typically get from the state. So with all of that in mind, I think that was why they chose to decline, to reduce what their ask was. Of course, that's always going to bring up attention that we see in a lot of different school districts, which is that you're only going to get, you know, at least, you know, what you ask for. And so as people have been pushing for more funding and higher teacher supplements, there has been some concern about whether or not they're being aggressive enough in their ask. Obviously, the county has seemed a little hesitant about funding more in the context of all of these issues they've been having.
And at a recent county commission meeting in Gaston County, there was some finger pointing from teachers and parents pointing those fingers at the county commission. One parent told them this is not a money problem. This is a priority problem. And a teacher added, this commission decides how much money our property taxes go to. How much of our property taxes go to our schools? Other counties have chosen to invest more. We do not. It looks like the commissioners either want to find a way to give more to the schools, or they received the message sent by those attending that meeting. Which is it?
Yeah, well, I know one of the things they've been exploring is this potential sales tax increase that could go towards schools. You know, I just think that this highlights sort of the tension that happens a lot in these budget discussions that pit sort of the school board against the county, and both of them also kind of under the weight of the state and the fact that the state, you know, is arguably not paying teachers enough and not funding schools enough. It often creates these sort of finger pointing kind of exercises where they're both looking at each other to fix the problem and don't have as much say in what's going on in Raleigh to fix the problem as well. So I think these tensions just kind of emerge to the surface as that's happening.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about Cabarrus County, because schools there say they need more money, but Cabarrus County commissioners have said they can't afford it, and they have retorted that the school system should have planned better for their budget. Okay, it sounds tense to me. What have school officials said about why they need more money?
Yeah, one of the interesting things about this, I think, is that the county did not even allow the schools to present their budget to them at their recent meeting about this. They said basically that they saw that the money was not percentage increase was not what they had been looking for, so they didn't even hear it. And one of the things school officials have said effectively is that if they had the opportunity to kind of explain why they had to do this, what their increased costs were, what their budget challenges were, they think they would have been able to add some more context. So that's definitely, you know, been a tense conversation. I know there's also been some talk in Cabarrus County that I think is adding some tensions to this about bathroom policy for transgender students. That's been a really heated debate in Cabarrus County right now. And I think that just highlights the way that a lot of these kind of local issues are butting up against these budgetary challenges and creating these really tense environments between schools and their counties.
But the county wants to fund them at literally half the level. The county commissioners told schools to operate within a projected 4.5 budget increase. The schools want 8.43% more. That's half or twice, depending which side of the equation you're on. And the county's already passed their budget. So is this a dead issue in Cabarrus County? Is what they have what they're going to get?
I'm not entirely sure. I have to kind of read up a little bit more on kind of where this is going next, but it certainly seems that way. There doesn't seem a lot of openness in the county's part to kind of maybe reconsider. It certainly won't be as high as what the school district is asking for.
So in Cabarrus County, the local funding accounts for about 27% of the district's operating budget. And if they don't get the requested increase, that would leave an estimated $8.5 million shortfall between revenue and projected expenses. I have 15 seconds, 30 seconds tops. That sounds like a big number. Is it?
Yeah, I think that sounds like a big number as well. I also just think that these kind of shortfalls are what we're seeing all around the state. Every school district is having these same problems, having to make these same tough decisions right now. In this case, it seems like the tension with the county is adding to that as well.
Will this be solved by some of the budget impasse things that fell by the wayside yesterday, or is this due to other things the legislature is doing to public education?
You know, it's so interesting because I'm sure that that'll help with some of it, but we also have the issue of declining enrollment that's affecting everything as well. There's a lot of factors involved.
James Farrell, thank you for your time.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.